Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. First order of business is going to be to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer. Backer. Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg. Freiberg. Grinhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Huang. Huang.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. Okay, a quorum is present. Is there a motion for approval of the minutes of March 3rd?
Freiberg is present. Sorry, Freiberg is present.
Okay. Welcome, Representative Freiberg. How would you like to move the minutes?
Sure, I'd love to. I read them. They looked amazing, and I would like to move the minutes of our last meeting.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Freiberg has moved approval of the minutes of March 3rd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if members would just unmute yourselves for a moment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? And the motion prevails. Thank you very much. I just love the unanimity we always have on the minutes. It's really a good way to start the meeting. Okay, the very first bill on the agenda for today, we have Representative Elkins with us, and he has three bills, and he has asked to start with House File 59. Am I right, Representative Elkins?
That is correct.
All right, so on your behalf, the chair will move that House File 59 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So go ahead and present House File 59.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an A2 amendment, author's amendment talk.
Yes, you do. Thank you. Okay, so the chair will move the author's amendment and the A2. And Representative Elkins, do you want to just give us just a really one sentence of what it is?
This gist of this amendment is it reflects a hard-worked wordsmithing amongst myself, Stefan Gildemeister of MDH, and Dave Renner of the Minnesota Medical Association, and all it does is clarify that the data that we're going to talk about in the All Payer Claims Database would be run, displayed at the medical practice level, would not disclose any information about individual clinicians, A, and then B, that it would not be used for the purposes discussed in the bill, and not unless and until the Department of Health is certified that it is accurate and suitable for this use.
Okay, so the chair will move the A2 amendment. This would just be a voice vote. Members, please unmute. All in favor of the A2, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, Representative Elkins, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the things I would like to do, I'm going to share my screen real quick. This bill is one of the collection. The reason we're hearing all of these together is that each of them provides a piece of a very complex puzzle related to making information about healthcare prices and drug prices available to consumers. So this one relates to the All Payer Claims Database. 57, which we'll hear right after that, relates to prices for medical services. The third one relates to prices for drugs, and it's in the context of other information that is also publicly available related to, for example, Medicare reimbursement rates, average drug prices that are paid for Medicare. So while it may be hard to see where any individual of these bills would fit in, or that, you know, why would the information requested by this particular bill be all that useful, yeah, they're much more useful when you look at them as a collection, as an integrated whole, to serve the need of making sure that consumers have access to price information. Because one of the things I've learned in researching this bill is that no one who provides health services wants any of us to know what their services cost until we get the bill. And this, what we're trying to do here is address that. So House File 59 relates to the state's existing all-payer claims database. So on none of these bills are we reinventing any wheels. So this is an existing database, but its usefulness has been limited because historically it contains all of the healthcare claims from the payers, but it's only had to be required submitted every 6 months. And while most of the payers are submitting the data monthly, there are a few that are still only reporting every 6 months, so the data can be very stale and not really suitable for medical research or reporting. So first thing that the bill requires is that all of the payers report their claims on a monthly basis so that the data is much fresher. And then we'll also be encouraging the plan administrators for ERISA plans to submit more of their plan data as well, so that we have a more complete set of the data. We had an extensive discussion of the privacy considerations of this bill in judiciary and civil law. Let it suffice today that this data is very private. It's completely de-identified. It's very secured. And in the reporting that will be done, nothing that will be available that could be used to re-identify a consumer in the bill. So again, what we're trying to do here is, update this database, improve the timeliness and the quality of the data that's in it, and then allow MDH to use it for both additional medical research and cost reporting.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Elkins, for that overview of the bill. And I see that we do have a question. We do have a couple of testifiers signed up.
No question. Just to let you know I'm here late, but I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Backer. Appreciate that. So let's go to our testifiers then, and we'll have some time for questions. So first on the list is Dave Renner from the Minnesota Medical Association. Welcome, Mr. Renner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Excuse me. My name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. And I first want to thank Representative Elkins. We've had a number of conversations on this legislation, and parts of this legislation we strongly support. Others, we still have some concerns, but I do appreciate the amendment that he put on, which addresses many of those concerns. But I do want to say that the MMA supports the All Payers Claim Database. The APCD has been a unique ability to capture claims data across all payers, and then the department has used that for a number of studies and analysis that has been very helpful for us to move forward. So we really appreciate the APCD and the power that it holds. However, we do need to point out that even with that, the APC does have limitations, and we think that we have to be careful for its future uses. The data is not timely enough currently for a number of purposes that are being suggested. Now, Representative Elkins' bill does try to address that by moving the reporting up, and we appreciate that. But we still have concerns about how granular this is. We need to point out, just to make sure people are well aware, that House File 59 poses a significant change to how the APCD purpose and its uses. And there are risks that come with that, both in the confidence and the trust of the APCD, but also the impact that it may have on providers. Representative Elkins, in offering the amendment, suggested and is trying to protect individual names of physicians and limit it down to clinics, hospitals, and medical practices, which we appreciate. But we just need to point out that in some cases, those are individual physicians. There are still solo practitioners. There are still individuals. But I, again, mostly want to really thank him for the A2 amendment, because I think that A2 amendment does try to address some of these concerns. It does ask the commissioner to ensure that the data is accurate, valid, and suitable prior to public publication, which I think goes a long way to address these concerns. But again, I just want to make sure the committee is well aware that this is a significant change in how we use the APCD today. And again, those are risks that go with that. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Renner. And Bentley Graves, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I, too, want to thank Representative Elkins for his engagement with us on this bill. We've had a number of conversations as well. And we represent more than 6,000 employers across the state, and we work on healthcare issues because healthcare benefits are an important benefits set for them to offer to their employees to keep them healthy and productive at work, but also to attract and retain talent. But on top of that, it's a very expensive benefit. And as we year in and year out, you know, have conversations with our members around some of the things they'd like to see, some of the direction they'd like to see the industry move in, you know, often that comes back to greater transparency, both around quality and cost. And while we're fortunate in Minnesota to have some tools at our disposal on both those fronts through outlets like the Minnesota Community Measurement, as Mr. Renner noted, this is the APCD has been in place for a long time, but has been limited in its uses. And so we support opening this up for more uses and to more people. We would note, though, to the some of the concerns that Mr. Renner expressed and that are similarly highlighted in a letter from MHA. You know, there are trade-offs associated with this, and we would certainly encourage continued conversation between the folks in the provider community with Representative Elkins to try and find some of those safeguards and a way forward on that. But we nevertheless appreciate the effort to make this a more useful tool, add this tool to the toolbox. We want to thank Representative Elkins for his work thus far. And I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any. But thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Graves. Appreciate your testimony. Are there member questions? I see one. Okay. Representative Backer.
I'm live. Okay. Thank you, Chair. A question I have on this, and this is to the author. I got two questions. Do you anticipate that there is going to be a fiscal note for this bill? If so, how much? And if not, why not?
Yeah, and you know what? We've got that. And just so before he addresses that, thanks for the question, Representative Backer. This was sent out not too long ago, so not too surprising if you hadn't seen it. But there is one, and it is in the packet, and it's $50,000 for the biennium. It's a one-time cost. And anything else you want to say about that, Representative Elkins? Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair. The fiscal note on this bill is modest because the data is already being collected. It's actually cheaper to collect it monthly than biennially, just because when you only send it every 6 months, the volumes are huge. And so there is some work to be done, and certifying the data is suitable, and getting preparing it for the additional uses. But there's very little IT costs or other costs with this. So this one, that the costs are modest.
Representative Backer, and I know you haven't had a chance to look at this. I know that because we're all very busy, and so. But hopefully this bill is being laid over. And so, hopefully if you have concerns about the fiscal note later, we'll be able to discuss that.
Representative
Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, Madam Chair, and so forth. I appreciate that. Yeah, that was definitely an oversight on my part there. So on this bill, I have no other questions. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And I have a question if for Mr. Renner, if no one else does have a question first. I like to give other members a chance. Okay, so my quick question, Mr. Renner, you talked about the privacy concern for providers. And so I'm in the Judiciary Committee, and I probably made this statement there. I'm less concerned personally about the privacy of providers. To me, that's in a very different bucket than the privacy of people who are getting health care, who obviously we want to be very protective of their privacy around their health care information. But can you kind of explain to me, give me an example of where privacy of a healthcare provider would be an issue? I just don't have a good sense of, you know, why that should be a concern.
Madam Chair, thank you. I completely agree with you that our number one concern is privacy about patient information. And again, Representative Elkins has tried to address that, and I think we don't have concerns there. Our concern is maybe not so much about privacy, but it is about the use of this data and potential reputation, and is the data accurate? I mean, the challenge you get when you get down to this kind of data, especially if you're talking about small providers, is if you have if you are a practitioner who serves high-risk patients, if you know your costs may be higher. So there's just this concern about the validity of the data, the reputation potentially that it may would have on a practitioner or a clinic if it's not valid. Again, Representative Elkins attempts to address some of those with the amendment, but that's the concern that we raise.
All right. Well, thank you for that explanation. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of chime in really briefly, and I certainly understand and appreciate much of what Mr. Brenner has said. But just for perspective, to just kind of underscore this point, some of the conversations we've had about uses of the data and so forth are sort of the same limitations we've always had. This bill doesn't really change that for the most part. But the when we talk about the accuracy and the timeliness of the data, and specifically the set of data that we're looking at, by making sure that we have that reporting every month rather than every 6 months, makes the data much more consistent and much more useful for folks across the spectrum who are using that data. So I really applaud Representative Elkins for this attempt, because I think this has been a challenge that many providers and so forth have actually had this conversation for literally years and years and years. And this is a good first step in addressing some of those concerns.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. So House File 59 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So let's turn now to House File 57, the first engrossment. So the chair will move that House File 57, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And there is no amendment on this one. Is there, Representative Elkins?
Not on this one, no.
Okay, very good. So, Representative Elkins, please go ahead and present House File 57, first engrossment.
Yes, so thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, like the previous one, builds on stuff that's already there. So starting in 2018, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services initiated a rulemaking process which requires hospitals to post selected pricing metrics on their websites in a machine-readable format, meaning like a spreadsheet or a CSV file. And at the beginning of this year, effective 2021, a new version of this rule goes into effect, which is much more detailed in terms of the information that is required to be filed. And it includes the charge master list price for each service, the cash price, which is available to uninsured patients if there is one offered by the facility, the median price received by the hospital for the service, the minimum and maximum prices received by the hospital for the service, it still requires that they be produced in a machine-readable format. However, the problem here is that it doesn't specify the format. And so I'm going to pull up another example here real quick. Oops, here we go. Just to illustrate the point. So I have gone looking for files that have been produced pursuant to this rule since the beginning of the year for local hospitals, which I might do business with. And I pulled up an example of just two of them there. The first one is a file that's produced by Hennepin Healthcare. The second one is the file by Allina Abbott Northwest. So most of this, you know, won't mean too much to somebody other than a healthcare numbers geek like me. The point I want to make with this is that both files are, you know, the columns are all in completely different orders, and which makes it almost impossible, you know, if you're any kind of a third party interested in compiling these data sets and producing a comparison report from them, which was the intent of CMS in requiring that these machine readable files be produced, is totally thwarted by the fact that each hospital is producing this data in its own format to the extent that they're publishing the data at all. And what's particularly aggravating to me, and especially with this particular example, is that I was able to reach out and finally connect with some folks at Epic Healthcare Systems in Madison, Wisconsin. Epic has about a 70% market share of all of the hospital systems in Minnesota, including most of the big ones in greater Minnesota as well, systems like Essentia. And what the folks at Epic told me is that, we actually provided a tool set to all of our customers to help them produce this report so that they wouldn't have to do it from scratch themselves. And I asked them, well, can you tell me if, you know, for example, this Hennepin Healthcare file was produced using your template? And they actually checked with Hennepin Healthcare and found out that, yes, this Hennepin Healthcare file was produced using the template that was provided by Epic Systems for this purpose. Clearly, the file produced by Abbott Northwestern was not, and I haven't found any other healthcare systems so far. Granted, I haven't checked all 140 of them that have done what Hennepin Healthcare did and produced the standard Epic file complying with the CMS rule. So. And what the other thing that Epic told me is that 300 out of their 400 hospital systems are taking advantage of their tools to produce in a consistent format this information. So what this bill does is say, that data that you're already providing for CMS, just put it in a consistent format so that the Department of Health or a third-party commercial vendor who is interested in doing so could easily import this into a database and use it to create comparison reports. So the bill requires that it be produced in a standard format at MDH's direction, and then further enables requires MDH to then compile this data and produce from it a consumer-friendly price reporting tool so that people could look at the prices, not just for an individual facility, but they could look up the procedure that has been ordered for them by their provider and compare the prices across facilities. So, and again, look at this example. I pulled up a procedure that I myself had performed on me a couple of weeks ago. It's a CT scan in my case to look for a reoccurrence of cancer. Fortunately, none was found. But you see in here that in terms of the list prices, the price of Hennepin Healthcare for this procedure is $1,000, where it's only $549 at Abbott Northwestern. The shopping that I've been able to do as a very knowledgeable healthcare consumer who spent the last 10 years of his career in this business, this kind of disparity is typical. And it would be nice to be able to compare the median price, which is probably more meaningful, but that field is actually missing from the Abbott Northwestern file. We have a letter from the hospital expressing their concerns about how much work for this, but for at least 70% of them, it would be almost no work at all to be able to produce a useful file of this sort for this manner.
All right.
So we have another letter in the file from CDI Imaging, and they expressed a concern that I want to address as well, and specifically related to scans like this. So one of the things, if you know how to read the data like I do, you would see that in the case of Abbott Northwestern, there's just basically one procedure, one price, whereas with Hennepin Healthcare, there's two lines here. There's the line for the scan $1,000, and there's a second line for $179. So you might scratch your head and say, what's the difference? Well, in this case, this little number here I know means it's the scan itself. Well, this code here means it's the radiologist interpreting the scan. So the CDI concern is that we want to make sure that when we're producing these reports, we're doing comparing apples and apples, so that we're comparing this combined price with this combined price. And so that's something that a kind of an important detail that MDH would need to address when they're producing the reports using this data. But the data to do that kind of thing, to make sure that the apples and apples comparisons are there, will be there in the data.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Elkins. We have a question from Representative Ryer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. This gives my data-loving heart an absolute headache, if such a thing is possible.
Yeah.
It makes me crazy, and I've spent too many hours of my life trying to pull data sets together. So thank you for this. My question, it's always the challenge comes up of, oh, it costs too much to reorganize our file. I've heard that a million times. I'm really curious what Epic would say about that, having given them tools.
Epic would ask about what?
Nope.
How Epic would respond to that concern about how hard it is to do this if they've provided a toolkit. So is there an opportunity for either them to go further with their toolkit if it's really so hard, or for them to weigh in on, no, it's not that hard, because look, this the tools and resources that we have provided make it a relative breeze. I just want to debunk, if it's appropriate, the line of reasoning that it's too hard to do this, because to me, this is a true detriment to consumers. We ask consumers to take responsibility for their health care, and then we put barriers in their way.
All right, Representative Elkins.
Yes. So when I spoke with the folks at Epic, basically what they said is that, look, we can lead the horse to water, but we can't make them drink. 300 of their 400 clients are taking advantage of this tool to produce the kind of file that Hennepin Healthcare has, but 100 of them, apparently including many in Minnesota, have not taken advantage of the tools that Epic is making available to them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Anything further, Representative Ryer?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you. So we have Representative Quam and then Schumacher. And just to note, there aren't any testifiers on this bill. And also, before we do go to Representative Quam, there is also a fiscal note on this bill that is in your packets. And I don't know if the questions pertain to the fiscal note. Maybe we should allow Representative Elkins to just briefly tell us what's in the fiscal note before we go to Representative Quam.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the fiscal note on this one is fairly significant. I think it's $800,000. Yeah, about $857,000 in this biennium. And Mr. Gildemeister for MDH is here and can answer questions if there are more detailed questions about this. But basically, MDH feels that if they're going to build a consumer-friendly price comparison tool, they want to do it right, and they want to make sure that it truly is user-friendly, and so they want to be able to engage with experts in creating this kind of a tool so that we can get it right the first time, and so that the tool that's produced really is useful to Minnesota consumers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the author for pointing out that you have a CT scan. There are other associated things. I know there are some special CT scanning equipment for people that have different needs, where there maybe would be an additional cost adder. You showed the charge for analyzing it, but if it's a neurologist or,
radiologist,
a cancer patient. I'm thinking about if you have a neurological condition, there may be a specialist that they would use for looking at that to be able, because for example, Mayo sees several in a week, where most hospitals might see something once every 2-3 months. And a lot of times you have a specialist that looks at, depending on what you're being seen for, is there any look at the complexity and the associated, if there maybe is some special equipment for immobilizing to get a higher resolution scan, et cetera, that could be the rest of the story that is part of the reason why one hospital is charging more. There's more included in that code on there, and another hospital breaks it out, so you've got it more itemized. I mean, is that some of the granularity differences that you have come up with your discussions?
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, and Representative Quam. In my experience, what I found that sometimes it's broken out. I take the comments from the CDI folks seriously. We need to make sure that where there's a breakout of the scan itself versus the interpretation of the scan. And in my case, the results are also going to be looked at by my oncologist as well. Those are all separate services, but they're all billed under standard industry billing codes. These particular ones are all current procedural technology CPT codes. So there, you should be getting apples to apples comparisons, especially on something like the scan itself. There may be different kinds of scanners, but that shouldn't affect the cost. I mean, you're not going to see that level of breakout in a hospital's charge master that one person went through this machine for that procedure and this person went through that machine. It's going to be billed by CPT code, and the CPT code price and the charge master is going to be set by that CPT code.
All right. Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair,
Representative Quam, go ahead.
The one follow-up is development of a decoder ring for the consumer or something overlaying the portal. I don't know if that's included in the fiscal note, but I think that might be a required thing to help our citizens. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Elkins, really appreciated the slides there. Whenever we can mash up Excel and PowerPoint, it makes my heart happy. I'm just looking at Minnesota Community Measurement and the Minnesota Health Scores website, and just trying to put together in my head where that effort and what you're proposing here in the last House file, how those compare and where they would be different. And so if you can help me figure out the juxtaposition on that, that'd be great. Thank
Representative Elkins.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher. I am a big fan of Minnesota Community Measurement. And quite frankly, I've had, conversations with them about, once we produce this file, would you guys be interested in picking it up and doing something with it? Because the thing that I found about, trying to use Minnesota Community Measurement for my own, shopping, is that they're only allowed to produce, price comparisons for a limited range of facilities and a limited range of services. And every time I tried to go there, for shopping for myself, I found that either the facility that I'm looking at isn't included in their database, and or the procedure that they're looking at that I'm looking at isn't in their database. So they've got a good sample of stuff. It's it's of academic interest, but I've not been able to, and I've tried. I really admire the work that they're doing, but I have not personally been able to use the information on that website to assist me in making care purchase decisions myself.
Okay, Representative Schumacher, any follow-up?
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Bierman, and then we're going to lay this bill over. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Just a kind of a follow-up onto that last conversation. I was just wondering on the number of procedures that are included or anticipated in this data that you'll be able to collect, and if you have any thoughts or can comment just on You mentioned some things are not included already, and I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of scope, being that everybody has different conditions, and as Representative Quam talked about, everything's slightly different. I know that, but is there kind of a benchmark or a number of procedures, top 500, or how is that?
Well, no, everything.
Representative Elkins.
I'm sorry, yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. Everything in the charge master will be on these files, but a big part of what MDH will have to do in terms of making this a useful tool is, creating like groupings of procedures. So you would want to make sure that if somebody's shopping for imaging procedures, that you can go to imaging procedures and just see that list. And there will be things that you'll want to edit out entirely. You're not going to want to include the cost of a Band-Aid. But that will be, a big part of the requirements gathering and design work that MDH would do as they're designing the tool.
All right.
Thank
Representative
you.
Bierman.
Thank you,
all right.
That's it.
All right. Thank you. So Representative, House File 57. The first engrossment is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And finally, Representative Elkins has House File 58, the first engrossment. The chair will move that House File 58, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Elections. And as we get started on this one, and we are running a little low on time, so we're going to have to zip through this a bit because we do have other bills. But I just would say that we do not have a fiscal note on this one because it is being reworked. And the costs that we believe are there are costs that would be carried in state government finance. Is that correct, Representative Elkins? So that's why we're moving.
For the most part, there are some MDH costs in here as well.
Okay. Well, we will deal
modest,
with that.
The big ticket item is the cost that were originally estimated with the first original draft of the bill. And there are amendments that some of which are relevant today that are dramatically affect the that fiscal note, which is why it's being redone those will be heard when we get to state government finance.
All right. Thank you. So go ahead, Representative Elkins, if you would, and very briefly explain, and we do have a number of testifiers on this bill, so I do want to give them an opportunity.
So, Madam Chair, I do have an A4 amendment to offer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you do. Okay, so the chair will move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. Can we unmute folks and all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you. The motion prevails. The A4 amendment is put on, and then Representative Elkins, if you would explain the bill with the amendment.
Yes,
thank
the
you.
Amendments, one of them exempts the repackaging activities of wholesalers from the bill. It's relatively minor. And then it deletes two of the requested data attributes for reporting. They're generally not available in the manufacturer databases, but they're needed, but MDH can supply them once they have the data.
Okay, Representative Elkins, we adopted the amendment, so I need you to explain the bill, and then, if you just point out where the amendment made the difference.
Okay, well, the main one that makes a difference is that the effective date for the portions that affect health plans and PBMs is pushed out to 2023 from 2022. In the course of discussing the aforementioned fiscal note, I realized that the timelines that I had laid out weren't realistic, so I can explain that. So let's go back here again real quick. And hold on. Oops. Okay, oops, wrong one. There we go. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so need to start with a quick overview, very quick, of the cycle of developing a plan and its formulary. So the cycle begins with a set of manufacturer wholesale acquisition cost list prices that are usually increased in January. During the spring, early summer, The plan's PBM negotiates discounts and rebates with manufacturers. Sometime in June, the plans have to submit their plans, and under this bill, the plan would have to include the formulary. Once the Commerce has approved the plan, consumers select a plan during the open enrollment period based on the plan description supplied to health plan shoppers by the plans. And in January, the plans become effective and the members of the plan begin submitting claims. So one of the problems that we're trying to address here is that and this bill has two major parts. The, you know, one part of it is we're requiring the manufacturers to let us know in advance what their January prices are going, increases are going to be. Because what happens now, we get around to January, as soon as the plans go into effect, all the manufacturers do big increases on their prices across the board. And, you know, obviously they're waiting until the new plan year has gone into effect and the formularies are locked in, consumer expectations have been set, and then the price increases come. So there's two. The first article of this bill says, okay, manufacturers, we know you're going to have a big price increase in January. We need you to tell, especially the plans and the PBMs, what those prices are increases are going to be in advance, so that they can bake them into the plan designs and formulary designs that they file with Commerce in June. That they then bake into the what the consumer buys in the fall and becomes effective in January. So it doesn't impose any controls on the what the manufacturers can charge. It just says, please tell us what they're going to be in advance, because then in the second article of the bill, if there are requirements that are imposed upon the PBMs and the plans. So the bill has been characterized as a formulary freeze bill. It is not a formulary freeze bill. The plans and the PBMs are still allowed to add new drugs to their formulary, make any changes to the formulary that are favorable to the consumer in terms of prices or conditions. If new generic drugs are coming onto the market, they can raise the prices of the existing drugs. As long as there's a generic that's at or below the price, there's nothing frozen about the plan. The one requirement that this adds is that if you're a consumer and back during the fall open enrollment, you chose a plan because a drug that you are taking right now was covered at a particular condition under a particular price point on that plan's formulary, the bill does require the plan and the PBM to allow that patient to stay on that drug at the original conditions for the course of that plan year until that consumer has an opportunity during the next open enrollment period to change their plan. That's really the only meaningful, constraint that exists on this bill on the ability of plans and PBMs to stabilize their formula. They do have to provide advance notice, 60 days in most cases, of significant changes to the formularies, but they're not frozen. But when
all
I was
right.
talking, just one more point, none of them will go, is that talking with the plans and the PBMs, it's like, well, how can you require us to do this if you're not also going to ask the manufacturers to freeze their prices? And so that's where the nexus is between the two. In order for this to work, the manufacturers also have to tell us in advance what their prices and increases are going to be so that the plans and PBMs can bake them into their formularies.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. And if you would take down the screen share.
Thank you.
And so I would just tell me if this is correct. I'm characterizing your bill as a consumer protection bill. This is something we've talked about over the years in this committee and other committees, that people buy a plan because it has a certain formulary, and then suddenly they find out that the formulary has been changed on them. They don't get the benefit of their bargain.
Exactly.
So this is to help consumers get the benefit of what they bought. And
exactly.
It seems just utterly fair. So anyway, we have a number of testifiers. I'm going to start with Mr. Renner. Welcome back, and please do the reintroduction.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Again, Dave Renner, today also representing Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, here to strongly support House File 58, especially Article 2 that you were just talking about, Madam Chair. We hear from physicians across the state nothing more infuriating that when a patient has been stabilized on a medication, then the insurer or the PBM changes that formulary preferred drug list, they can no longer keep their patient on that drug without significant out-of-pocket costs. Many times this happens without the prescriber being informed and clearly without the patient being informed. And it really is frustrating when as you just pointed out, Madam Chair, that the patient is, the enrollee is in a contract and can't get out of that contract, but yet the medication that they need and they chose that plan for is now no longer covered. We hear that this is being done in the name of cost savings, but we can tell you that we hear these stories all the time of a patient with asthma who needs an inhaler, but an inhaler is no longer covered. They show up at the emergency room. A mental health patient, again, can't get the medication. So those are significant concerns. Article 2 really does two things. In addition to that language that Representative Elkins talked about that says that once you've started a drug, you're allowed to stay on that drug. There's also some language in here to require that the PBMs use real-time prescription benefit standards that are being developed by the National Council of Prescription Drug Programs. Again, many times physicians will say, we want to cover the drug that's covered, but we don't know what it is ahead of time. So that we think is also really critical. Again, I think as Representative Elkins said, this bill does not free the formulary. So they can always add new drugs. They can make cheaper drugs. I just can't force a patient who has started a medication to change if it's working for them. So with that, Madam Chair, I again be happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Renner. Next is Michelle Mack. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA. PCMA represents America's PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to testify in House File 58 and acknowledges and appreciates Representative Elkins for looking for ways to balance a complicated system. We respectfully are opposed given our industry has significant concerns about the bill, specifically Article 2, Section 3, which we refer to as frozen formulary, but Representative Elkins has indicated he terms it as something else. We believe this will restrict our ability to put downward pressure on pharmaceutical manufacturers to limit the increase of prescription drug costs. We applaud the sponsor for including language that would prohibit pharmaceutical manufacturers from increasing the wholesale acquisition cost of a drug on a formulary. This shows an acknowledgement that there is a cost association to the frozen formulary portion of the bill. A report recently released by Milliman shows that this type of policy would cost Minnesota healthcare payers $75 million over 5 years. Unfortunately, the state also does not have the authority to limit what pharmaceutical manufacturers charge. PBMs help provide their members access to safe, effective, and affordable medications, but pricing in the drug market is volatile, and there are very few tools to incent drug manufacturers to reduce prices. Formulary placement and financial incentives to use low-cost generics and brand alternatives are among those tools, and this bill threatened those cost savings mechanisms. Currently, there are appeals processes which health plans and PBMs have in place for patients to access a non-formulary drug. The health plan or PBM works with the patient and his or her provider to provide access to non-formulary drugs where medically necessary and or likely to create the best clinical outcome. We believe our appeals processes are fair and responsive. In closing, PCMA believes that House File 58 will raise prescription drug costs as it removes important tools that PBMs use to deliver high-quality services. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mack. Next is Leanne Gassaway.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairwoman. I was asked to testify regarding the fiscal note, and I understand that the discussion is being moved to next week. So I defer my time back to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And before I go further, Representative Bonner, you have your hand up. Can we wait till we get through the testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, Bentley Graves, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We at the chamber have been involved in this conversation about, you know, whether you want to call it frozen formulary or formulary changes for a number of years. And I think many of you have been around this conversation as well. And it is for, you know, the issues at play are those that have been described thus far. Chair Liebling, you point out the kind of the fairness question that this quickly elicits and brings forward. But as we know from the fiscal vote, that there are some associated cost concerns as well. So we've long struggled kind of with this and have frankly appreciated Representative Elkins' creative approach to try and kind of break this loose this year. But we nevertheless have, you know, some concern about the idea of leveraging kind of the freezing of prices in order to kind of make this work. And so, you know, we nevertheless want to be part of this conversation going forward. You know, it is a difficult thing to try and kind of unravel. And as you, Madam Chair, point out, and the other testifiers have pointed out, there is a struggle here to try and kind of overcome the access to drugs, continued access to drugs, while still balancing the cost concerns. But again, we appreciate the outside of the box thinking. Nevertheless, have concerns about this particular approach, but want to commit to continue to work on this with the other stakeholders. So thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Graves. Next, we have Brett Michelin. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Brett Michelin with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the manufacturers of generic and biosimilar medications. Since I testified earlier this week, I'm going to skip over a lot of the discussion on the value proposition that generics bring and the cost savings that they apply. But we are opposed to this bill based on two of the provisions. The first being a requirement for all manufacturers to report the WAC price of any drug over $100. First of all, we think, especially on the generic side, this could cause great confusion. Once we sell a drug to a wholesaler, and three wholesalers buy 90% of all generic drugs, we're out of the pricing game. When you start looking at what the WAC is, it's merely a point of negotiation that starts the discussion with the wholesaler. So it actually doesn't really relate to what the patient is ultimately going to pay. Patient average costs right now are about $6 for a generic drug. And that is set by the PBM and the insurance company, not by the manufacturer. One reason why just listing the WAC, so one of the drugs that we talked about earlier this week was Prozac. There's 38 manufacturers that all have a different WAC price, from $1.61 to nearly $800. If a patient's going to go on, it's not like the bills that Representative Elkins was talking earlier, where they can cost compare and purchase a particular generic drug. They're the same drug, and which one from which manufacturer they're going to get, again, is set by the insurer, the PBM, the wholesaler, to the pharmacy, not the manufacturer. The second provision that we're concerned with is where it prohibits any WAC changes once the drug has been approved on a formulary. On the generic side, the reason that we have so significant of savings is because of the commodity competition pricing in the generic side. We are competing against other manufacturers selling the exact same drug, and the only thing the wholesalers really care about is what is the lowest price and can you supply the amount that we need. Based on that, that's why the WAC will fluctuate a little bit. And finally, I don't think formularies are typically set at one time during the year. And so if you're a manufacturer of a drug and you have to set your formulary at one point and you have various insurers or PBMs setting different formularies because they're all different, then we wouldn't actually be able to have any price fluctuations within the market, which eliminates the competition, which is what is saving money on the generic side. And for those reasons, we're opposed, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Michelin. And Peter Fjellstad. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Peter Fjellstad. I'm a senior director for state policy for Pharma, the trade association of 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medicines. Today, I'd respectfully oppose House File 58. First, I'd like to start off by saying that we appreciate Representative Elkins' bill for the fact that it takes a look at the entire pharmaceutical supply chain by shining some light on what the health plans and their contracted PBMs are doing with the prescription drug benefits they administer, especially with the language he's included in Article 2 of the bill. Those provisions deal with issues that will be particularly helpful in determining why pharmaceutical manufacturer rebates or coupons aren't reaching consumers at the pharmacy counter or through their mail-in pharmacy. Truth is, the real problem with the cost of prescription drugs is health plan benefit design. It's increasingly led to common instances for Minnesotans not seeing their health insurer adjust the price of their medicines at a reasonable cost. Instead, Minnesotans are experiencing higher deductibles and higher copays at the counter. Second, it's not true that drug prices are continually rising. In fact, according to IQVIA, in their August 20 medicine spending report, the consulting firm Brand Name Medicine, net prices increased 1.7 on average in 2019, below the rate of inflation for the third year in a row. Third, I know that Representative Elkins wants to have another hearing with the fiscal note on the bill, but right now, due to the fact that pharmaceutical rebates will be lost for CGIP.
And Mr. Fjellstedt, I would ask you not to. Let's not go into that because we don't have time here and we don't have that before us. So,
okay, I will just finish up your labeling. Fourth, regarding the additional manufacturing requirements reporting in the bill, we don't have the necessary information based on the 2020 law yet, which won't be sent in by manufacturers until August of 2021, or it's 7 months from now, and not reported to the legislature by MDH until January of 2021. Lastly, we believe this bill contains a harmful price control that could harm research and development as well as patient access to needed medicines. That language is on lines 7.11 to 7.16 of the bill, along with legal concerns. Chair Liebling and members of the committee, thank you for your time. I stand happy to answer any questions that you may need. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Fjellstedt. And so I have three members on the list. We're going to go to the members. I just would ask members to please, state your question briefly if you can, because we do have three other bills on the agenda. So we have Bonner, Grunhagen, and Ryer. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Elkins. I want to say thank you to Representative Elkins for this really thoughtful and balanced approach to this issue. I know this is a really complex and difficult issue. One of the things I also wanted to bring out is that I guess I'm really disappointed in that once again, we have folks here on the phone in opposition. And what I hear in a lot of that, and I suspect the general public does too, is a lot of finger pointing. And a lot of, it's not our fault, it's their fault. It's somebody else's fault. And really not taking ownership of their piece of the puzzle. And I find that extremely frustrating. This is one of the few areas where we ask a consumer to sign a contract for a year, and then we change the rules of the game halfway through on that consumer. I don't know many areas of business where that is acceptable or appropriate. And I think this bill attempts to understand the marketplace, understand the limitations that they have, and really balance the needs of the consumer with the marketplace itself. So it is my hope that all of the folks on the phone here today who were in opposition will work closely with the bill's author to find a way to make it work, because I think this is probably one of the most balanced approaches we have yet to hear. And quite frankly, I would hope that they would be willing to work out the issues that they may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my question would be for Ms. Mack and Mr. Michelin, if they would respond. I identify with some of your concerns about the bill. On the other hand, Mr. Renner's comment about doctors giving medication that's working with a particular patient and suddenly it's switched and they have to use different medication, which in some cases isn't as effective. That is a major, it's a critical problem in my opinion. I've had customers, I work with health insurance or Part D drug plans and also individual health insurance. And I've had more than one complaint from my customers that this has been done to them and they've had negative reactions. So how do we solve that problem that Mr. Renner brought up? Because I think it is a major concern, and it endangers people's health care and treatment, if they'd like to respond to that.
So you asked two people, Representative Grinhagen. I wonder if maybe Mr. Fjellstad might be the most appropriate person to answer that one, because his jurisdiction's kind of the broadest here. Mr. Okay. Fjellstad?
Representative Grinhagen, would you mind repeating the question? I was paying attention when you
well, Mr. Fjellstad, he's asking you to respond to Mr. Renner's concerns about patients who are taken off a medication because of a change in the formulary mid-year and have to get a new medication that maybe doesn't work as well.
Yeah, I would say just generally with Chair Liebling, Representative Grinhagen, just generally without without a specific instance of that, certainly that's a primary concern of our organization is patient access to the medications as prescribed to them by their providers. And when they have to change a medication that is working for them, that's one of our highest priorities and one of our biggest concerns. Hopefully that answers the question.
And you know what, Representative Grinhagen, let's ask Ms. Mack that, because she's representing the PBMs, and this is probably more of a PBM thing, actually.
That's what I think.
If that's okay. Yeah, yep. Ms. Mack?
Yep. Chair Liebling, Representative Grinhagen, yes, actually, that is a concern of ours as well. And that's why we have the appeals process in place. So, you know, when there is a change, I mean, a formulary is just a rule. And, you know, I think we can think of it as there's always exceptions to the rules. And that's what happens. So that is how we handle those issues.
Representative Grinhagen, yeah.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, all I'd say is you've got to give some discretion to the doctor on that. They're the ones with the patient. They know that what's working. And sure, you got this appeals process, but I've seen these appeals process work. And they drag out. People need the treatment. They're switched off the medication, and they're suffering consequences. So you've got to give some credibility to the doctor to say, no, I want them to stay on this particular medication. I don't understand how we circumvent the doctor-patient relationship on medication that they think are working and switching them in mid-treatment. So just food for thought. Think about how you can correct that.
Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. And I was going to go to Mr. Renner, but I don't think I need to now. He was nodding along with you. And I think if we took a vote on that right now, I think we'd probably pass it unanimously. Representative Ryer, and then Damuth, and then we're going to go to a vote on the bill. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm echoing Representative Bonner a little bit, but I want to point out that the person who should be at the core of our attention in all of these discussions is the patient, the person, the human who's getting care. And when I hear all of the rationales and the, well, but we can't because of this and we can't because of that, and I look at the fundamentals of the contract that's being violated, to me, I just keep coming back unavoidably to bait and switch, and it's really frustrating. What I would like to hear in a hearing like this is come with objections. You have every reason to say, from the point of view of our business model, here are concerns we have, and come with solutions. Come with your recommendations. Solve the problem. It's a fundamental problem that people are making decisions based on medicines that they can get, and then, whoops, they can't. That's a fundamental issue, and I challenge you to say, here is a way that we can solve that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill's author, thank you for bringing this forward. I understand, Madam Chair, as you explained about the fiscal note, that it is being corrected and that we don't have that. One concern that I have, though, is knowing that the bill would prohibit the drug formulary changes, you know, during the year. We know that CGIP in 2020 saved at least $30 million from mid-year formulary changes. So for the bill's author, is that being taken into consideration, or would it be? And then I do have a follow-up.
Madam Representative Chair, Elkin. Representative Damuth, we'll be discussing that in state government finance. The amendments to the bill, the original fiscal note included the impact of a prior authorization provision, which was removed from the bill when it was heard in Commerce. And I think that the change in the effective date for PBMs from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2023 is going to largely address most of those impacts. So that we won't know until we get the next version of the fiscal note.
Representative Damuth.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, maybe a question for you, being my first year on this committee, I'm happy to serve here, but because of the lack of that fiscal note, and it sounds like there's going to be considerable changes, will this bill be coming back to us as a Health Finance Committee, or what happens to it after?
Well, yeah. Representative Damuth, it really kind of depends on what happens in state government and what that fiscal note looks like. So, you know, sometimes fiscal notes have costs in different committees, and then the costs have to be carried in that committee. If we're going to carry costs from this, then we'll bring it back and look at the fiscal note. So we'll see how that works.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So I think we are ready to vote on this. Representative Elkins, I'll give you 30 seconds to conclude.
You know, I'll pretty much give it back to you, I think.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We've had a really good discussion here. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, so I'm going to renew my motion that House File 58 as the first engrossment and as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Finance, and Elections, and the chair votes aye.
Raise my aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Leach Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Damuth votes no.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel. Representative Keel.
Keel votes no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Right, there being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to state government finance. Thank you very much, Representative Elkins. Thank you for all your hard work on these issues on behalf of Minnesotans. Really appreciate that. Next on the agenda, we have House File 1793, which is Representative Morrison. And this one is going to be Representative Morrison's motion to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1793 provides Medicaid coverage for home environmental assessments and for durable medical equipment to treat poorly managed asthma in children. Asthma is a cruel disease. At its worst, it involves attacks of acute breathing difficulties. It often requires intensive respiratory treatment and ongoing medications. Anyone who has witnessed or experienced an acute asthma attack knows the terror it can induce, especially for children and their parents. We can do better in treating this common disease. One in 14 children in Minnesota has asthma, and for 25% of those kids, their asthma is not well controlled. This bill provides coverage beyond the core medical treatments required to manage asthma. It looks at where kids live, their homes, and assesses the environmental triggers that may be contributing to their condition. It provides practical, low-cost equipment and supplies to parents and caregivers to address the allergens in a child's home that trigger attacks or aggravate symptoms. Besides supporting good, effective health care, this bill saves money. A study from the Minnesota Department of Health found that providing an in-home visit and product interventions cost an average of $468 and saved an average of $2,428, an overall savings of almost $2,000 per child. It's time to pass this common sense bill. Everyone wins: children with asthma, their families, healthcare providers, and insurers and taxpayers. I do have one testifier, I believe, today, Madam Chair, Ramsey County Commissioner Nicole Fretham.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. Ms. Fretham, welcome. Commissioner Fretham.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Ramsey County Commissioner Nicole Fretham, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1793. Ramsey County is one of the few counties that offers asthma support through our Healthy Homes program. During a home visit from an environmental health specialist and public health nurse, we help identify environmental triggers in the home and provide individualized asthma education. When applicable, we provide durable medical equipment, which in these cases may include items such as a HEPA filter for the vacuum, bed and pillow encasements, or pest control supplies. A typical child referred to our program has multiple emergency room visits every year. 4 to 6 visits is not uncommon, and estimated costs for each ER treatment are between $2,500 and $3,000. This does not include the additional costs the family bears related to the emergency room visits, which can include childcare costs for other children in the home, loss of income if a parent doesn't have paid sick time, transportation costs, and the increased need for other subsidies to offset these losses. Minnesota children living in low-income communities are more likely than children living in higher-income communities to have been hospitalized for asthma. In my past work as a child care provider, I cared for many children with severe asthma, and the vast majority of whom were children of color from families with lower incomes. An asthma home assessment and intervention typically costs around $600 to $700 in Ramsey County, including the products we provide to the family to mitigate asthma symptoms. A large majority of the families who participate are able to manage their child's asthma much better after intervention, using their primary care provider more and rarely returning to the ER. There is that much improvement from 1 or 2 home visits and simply providing these necessary products. This work makes a real difference in the short and long-term health and well-being of the kids we work with. Asthma is the number one reason for school absence, and with their asthma controlled, kids can do better in school and in life. Promoting the health of these children through cost-effective preventative measures provides family stability and ensures that parents can focus on supporting their family's future rather than dealing with ongoing health crises. Thank you for your time today and your support of House File 1793, and I am happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Commissioner, for your testimony. And I don't see any questions, and we don't have a lot of time, but I just appreciate this bill. And we do not have a fiscal note yet, members, but we did have this bill. Representative Morrison, I believe, carried this bill in the last biennium. And this is a bill for an expanded Medicaid benefit that actually saves money. On the fiscal note, this is a really rare animal that we don't see very often where this is so well described. This is so, the connection to the reduction in healthcare costs is so close that it is brought into the fiscal note and shown as a savings, and the human savings, as Representative Morrison has said and the commissioner have said, are just tremendous. So this is just a win-win. And Representative Morrison, I'll let you have the final word, and then we'll lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't have said it better than you already did. So thank you very much. This bill's been around for a while, and I think it's time for us to proceed with it. Let's do it for kids and families. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for carrying this again. We really appreciate it. And House File, let's see, what is the number here? House File 1793 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. We're going to move then to House File 1413. Representative Edelson is here, and the chair will move House File 1413 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an author's amendment. And Representative Edelson, that's kind of a substantial amendment. Am I correct?
You know, I can. There's just two things that it really does. It, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well then, Representative Edelson, the chair will move House the A4 amendment. So please go ahead and describe the amendment.
Sure, Madam Chair. It gives the caregiver. It expands the caregiver to be able to serve six patients, ensuring that patients get needs met, and it also clarifies medical cannabis prescription.
Okay, and Representative Edelson, you cut out a little bit there. I don't think it was just to me, but you said it expands.
Oh, sorry. It clarifies that a pharmacy technician can refill medication. So it's just clarifying language for the most part on part of it.
And then okay. Did you hear the part? I think we heard the rest. Okay. So anyway, I don't see any questions. Are there questions to the amendment? Shall we go ahead and adopt the amendment and then we'll discuss the bill? So the chair is moving the A4 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Edelson, if you can just quickly describe this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1413 is moving in the Senate. It has bipartisan support. I'm just going to walk through just a few little points of exactly what the bill does. It adds definition around a hemp processor to the medical cannabis statute. It allows medical cannabis manufacturers to acquire hemp products and so they can use at their facilities. It modifies requirements for pharmacists consultations with the patient. It allows consultations to occur by telephone and remotely, which is what currently is happening right now with COVID. It eliminates the requirement that the consultation must take place in person. It allows the manufacturer to distribute medical cannabis to a patient, registered caregiver, and other caregiver who is at the distribution facility, but can remain in their vehicle. It exempts the manufacturer from being required to grind the medical cannabis plant root balls, which I just wanna make sure members know a root ball because I didn't know what it was until I talked to the manufacturer. It actually no longer can be turned into a plant at this point. It has lived its life. It's very costly to grind it down. Some of the machines are cost $15,000 and it no longer contains THC. This bill also allows the Commissioner of Health to execute data sharing arrangements with the Commissioner of Agriculture due to the hemp issue. And that is what the bill does, Madam Chair.
All right.
And I don't have any testifiers, but if members have questions, I do have Bill Parker, the president of Leafline, and I also have Marin Schroeder here, who is the patient advocate.
Okay, well, great. So thank you for that. So I think what we'll do is, because we are really short on time and we do have another bill after this one as well, I would like to go to questions now if we could. And I see we have a question from Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill's author, thank you for bringing this forward. I just want to address one thing. It is moving in the Senate and it is traveling on its own. And I believe that the time that this bill would go into effect would be, is it August 1st that's on the bill to the bill's author? Is that correct?
Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, Representative Munson, yes. And right now, I have notified Chair Liebling that we are working with the Office of Medical Cannabis in terms of what that would look like. It probably will need to change, and which is why we will be giving that language to the chair when she brings her omnibus to make changes at that point.
Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you. And I just was, I guess I would ask the chair if the motion could actually be to send the bill to the general register as opposed to sending it to, you know, to laying it over, because I think this is an important bill and to wait until late in the session for this to pass into law would be delaying, you know, this important cost reduction for patients. So, I mean, if you sent it to the general register, you could still include the language in the omnibus bill, but I guess it would be up to the chair, but I'd like to make that request.
Well, Representative Munson, this bill has fiscal implications too. And so we want to include it in the omnibus bill. So that would be our intention. And, you know, I, just to say, I've also spoken to Senator Benson about this issue. And I think that we have a very high likelihood of getting some things accomplished and doing it in our omnibus bill this year. So I just would say that there's a lot of bipartisan agreement around this bill. Anyway, any further questions before we lay this bill over? All right, not seeing any. Well, thank you very much, Representative Edelson, and for doing it in record time. Really appreciate that. So House File 1413, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Keel's bill, House File 1483. Representative Keel, and the motion here is that the 1483 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Keel, is there an amendment to this bill?
No, ma'am. I do not.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a short amount of time. This is a bill that would keep the finances, the prescription drugs from being purchased in other states with some exceptions. And this has been going on in other states. Indiana has passed it, Georgia, Louisiana, and Rhode Island. It also does some other things, but I, you know, we have short time here. So I have a testifier, Mr. John Selner, pharmacist in a business in Mendota Heights, and maybe we could have him. No, I didn't even look to see if he was here.
I'm here.
Yeah, oh, there we go. He's here. And just before we go to your testifier, Representative Keel, I just want to make sure that it was recorded that you're moving the bill for possible inclusion. I just want to make sure that.
Yes,
got
ma'am.
Recorded. Yes,
I would
thank
like to
you.
Move the House File 1483 for possible inclusion. Yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Selner.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives, for having me testify today in support of Bill HF 1483. As said before, my name is John Selner. I'm the Director of Pharmacy at Sterling Specialty Pharmacy in Mendota Heights, Minnesota. And what essentially this bill will do, aside from keeping some of the tax dollars within the state of Minnesota, it does a couple other things as well. So first, it promotes local businesses. So I pulled 10 claims today out of my own pharmacy software because I wanted to see, you know, what has been mandated out. And in the last few months, for just two different insurance companies, we've had to mandate out 10 prescriptions, five of which were actually for rural Minnesotans. This can be a big impact as they could potentially receive their medications at a local pharmacy. And during our pandemic, you know, we really want to help a small business any way we can. Better patient care. I'm sure many of you get things through Amazon or you get packages in the mail. Well, the same can be said for drugs. By mandating these prescriptions out, these prescriptions are leaving Minnesota. So Minnesota is not capturing the tax dollars on them, but they're also being filled in other states all the way across the country. So for instance, I had a patient this last summer I filled a prescription for, a cancer patient out of Mora, Minnesota. He was down his last dose of medication, and I spent the afternoon driving to his house about 2.5 hours away to give him that medication. Obviously, the patient was ecstatic we were able to get it to him. However, if this patient would have been a managed Medicaid patient and it was mandated out, much like the 10 I previously mentioned, it's possible this patient would have gotten their dose for a week, maybe 2 weeks. This is even more important, you know, if you remember what's happening in the southern U.S. right now with FedEx's corporate office is located out of Tennessee. And because of that, medications are first being routed to Tennessee, and then they're being delivered back. So we're having instances where I could have driven the medication to Fridley, where my mother-in-law is at, to a patient to get the medication right now today, and the state of Minnesota gets their money, and they get local business opportunities. But instead, we're transferring all these prescriptions out, and they're being mandated out to other states. Lastly, there is an environmental and cost-friendly option. You know, by sending things out of states, you know, there's been a lot of conversation lately about carbon footprints. So things cost money. Delivering packaging costs money to make. You guys probably all have lots of Amazon packages laying around, and I get mine almost daily. So by sending things out of state, you're also increasing our carbon footprint, and you're also increasing the shipping costs, gas and fuel prices. and you're increasing all the packaging requirements and the cost that they involve. So, you know, I really think this is a great bill. I mean, I'm in full testimony of it. I've worked at lots of different pharmacies, and I think I have a good experience with what's going on. But Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you and the representatives for allowing me to testify, and I welcome any questions about this issue.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Selner, for being here. And that's all the testifiers that I have listed. And I wonder if, are there member questions? Okay. So I'm not seeing any member questions. I guess I have a question, Mr. Selner, and I'm not sure where I saw this, but I think I read somewhere that there might be constitutional concerns with this bill, and I'm not sure if you're the right person to answer that because, you know, I don't know if there's anybody on the call that could address that. And of course, this is not the Judiciary Committee, so we don't want to go too far into that, but.
No, of course. And, you know, I'm probably not the speaker expert about this constitutionally. You know, I'm here to speak, obviously, on behalf of the cost savings, the patient care, et cetera.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Okay. Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess maybe just answered it. I wasn't clear if this was a bill that would save money or if we're going to be denying patients the ability to buy prescriptions online, perhaps out of state for less money. But it sounds like this bill does save money, lower costs.
And right? Then yeah. Is maybe that's for the author, Representative Keel?
I believe that it will save money, except for the fact that if it is money that would be spent anyway in the state. So I don't know if we'd be saving a whole lot of money, but it would also, my opinion is that it would provide more access. I myself live in the country and had some real challenges with getting medicine. I can drive to town. In fact, during COVID, I finally told them, please don't mail it because you're worrying about weather conditions and those types of things. But yes, in fact, it is providing money that we are spending out of the state anyway.
Mr. Selner, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually twofold. So there's revenue possibilities, right? So there's Minnesota taxes on all prescriptions dispensed within Minnesota. So the first, there's revenue opportunities for the state, but I would argue there's significant cost savings. You know, how the prescription transfer process will a lot of times work is, you know, a prescription comes into my pharmacy, I intake the patient information, I attempt to bill it, and the prescription is either covered or not covered. If it's not covered, I can't even usually tell the patient whether it's actually covered. It's just not covered at my pharmacy. So what's happening is I'm sending prescriptions across the country, like to Florida, where then that pharmacy is going to try to bill it because it was mandated to them by the PBM. And then that pharmacy will tell the patient, sorry, needs a PA. And so you can imagine that's already a frustration for time delays right there. But also these pharmacies are then calling the clinic and saying, I can't take this transfer as a legal script for audit reasons. They'll call the clinic and lead to even more confusion. So we have delays in therapy, which can lead to increased lab draws, obviously, like this patient that took place up in Mora, Minnesota. But you can also have revenue savings for the state of Minnesota, but also, you know, health system savings, which is a huge deal. So,
All right. Thank you, Mr. Selner. And Representative Munson, did you have a quick follow-up?
Well, I just wanted to ask also about the pharmaceutical benefit manager rebates and such. Are they still for out of state? But that's, I guess,
It's probably more than we can get into right now. I just wanted to check with Mr. Berg whether this is a bill that would be fiscal noted or if there is one ordered or because it's been mentioned whether the impact possibly on the state, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, there I do have a request in on it for exactly the issues that just came up. If there were impacts on rebates to within our public programs, for instance, that could be an issue. So there is an active request.
All right. Good to know. So we're laying the bill over, and you know, of course, we'll follow up with that. So, Mr. Selner, thank you very much, and Representative Keel, thank you very much. So, House File 1483 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Appreciate your presentation today. So members, the next meeting is March 8th. That's Monday at 1:00. And the agenda for that is posted. I wish you all a relaxing weekend. I hope you have a weekend. I guess that's what we say now. So with that, we are adjourned.